Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
And welcome, genies, to another action-packed edition of Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. I am Fisher, your radio root sleuth, on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. And I hope that you took a ton of pictures of family members that your descendants will be struggling to identify 100 years from now. You understand what I'm saying, right? Of course. And I hope you taped interviews with your senior family members and got all kinds of stories that you'll not forget, store, share, record, and all that good stuff. There is no better time of the year for family history than right now. And on the show today, we'll be talking with a woman who is up to her knees in the indexing project involving veterans of the War of 1812. If you had an ancestor who was part of that little disagreement with Great Britain, you'll want to hear what's happening to make sure you have access to the records of your people. It's a phenomenal effort. Then later in the show, you'll hear about a night that affected a lot of our ancestors. Many of them even wrote about it. It was dubbed the Night the Stars Fell, and some crazy stuff happened that evening. But right now, of course, it is time to check in with our good friend David Allen Lambert, chief genealogist for the New England Historic Genealogical Society and American Ancestors in Boston. Hi, David. How are you?
Hey, Fish, I'm doing great. How about yourself?
I am doing awesome. Of course, still refreshed from my little excursion up to Alaska.
That makes reference to an email that you sent me with a photograph of you with a totem pole.
Yes. And, you know, I didn't even know that they put family history on totem poles until I was there. It was amazing.
Well, it's amazing. Now, that wasn't an ancestor by any chance.
No.
Okay, well, one thing that may be an ancestor is something that was found back in the 1890s that directly links to the Northwest totem poles. This is a 9-foot wooden idol that was found back in 1890 in a peat bog in Siberia. Now, the thing about this is older than you might believe. It is actually 11,000 years old.
Ooh. 9,000 BC, really?
Amazing, isn't it?
How'd they figure this out?
They've used radiocarbon dating, and because of this, we know it's 11,000 years old, which actually makes it twice as old as the Great Pyramids of Giza.
Wow.
The nice thing about this is that this actually gives a nice link between the time when the Native Americans are coming across the Bering Land Bridge into North America, and of course the traditions, as you've seen recently, of the Northwest with totem poles ties perfectly to this tradition in Siberia, which is 11,000 years ago.
Boy, that is just an incredible find. I love hearing this stuff. Every week there's something new.
It really is exciting.
Or old.
It's nice to know that old news becomes new from something found that long ago. Well, some new news is going on in Fort Wayne, Indiana at the Allen County Public Library. You may have visited this wonderful facility.
It's like the number two biggest in the world to the one in Salt Lake City.
That's very true. And they are having a $100,000 plus renovation of the 2,000 square foot downtown center. It's going to make genealogists a lot happier. It's going to go on in November, so there'll probably be some disruption of service. So check out their website to find out what's going on before you head down to Fort Wayne.
That's great news for Midwesterners.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's funny. I often don't talk about my own dirty laundry, but one of my black sheep ancestors, which I may have talked to you about, my own grandfather. And at NEHGS, we just did a little video, which is up on YouTube, of a photograph. Remember a couple weeks ago we talked about the alien registration files?
Yeah, those are great.
Within that file, I found the only photograph that we have of my grandfather.
That's fantastic.
It's a little passport-sized photo, has a signature on it, but because I have no other photographs, I cherish this probably as much as anything I do in my genealogical collection. But the ironic thing is I found it a year to the week my father died.
Oh.
And it was his dad. He always said, you know, Dave, can you find what happened to my father? He disappeared. Unfortunately, I think this bootlegger and person who sidestepped the law quite a bit died on the streets of Boston.
You think or you know?
I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
He died as a John Doe. He isn't in any records that I've found. But this is a nice little video, and you get to see how much I don't look like my grandfather.
Well, let's link that video to our Facebook page from extremegenes.com. That sounds great.
Yep, I'd be glad to do that. We have some exciting news at NEHGS. We have a Labor Day experience for September 2nd to September 9th. We're offering to our guest users census, tax, and voter lists over 40 separate databases. Those are going to be free to our guest users. And that leads me to a tech tip that you may have never tried. Have you? Well, you probably have. Ever drawn the floor plan of your childhood home?
It is so bizarre you would say that. I was thinking about this just a couple of nights ago, because I have all these photographs from around our house, indoors and outdoors, and I thought it would be kind of fun to take some of them and put them together and basically take a tour of the house and then perhaps draw the layout of exactly, you know, how it all was and where the shelves were and where this was and where that was. It would be quite fun, I think.
Well, I think with graph paper, but now with CAD programs that are pretty reasonable in price, you could probably lay out the floor plan. Like if you were going to do a renovation of your house, how about doing a recreation of your old house?
Right. And or your grandfather's house.
Exactly. Or interview somebody and sit down and have them draw out where the kitchen was, where the bedrooms were, who slept in what room. Great stuff.
He's David Allen Lambert, Chief Genealogist for the New England Historic Genealogical Society and American Ancestors. Thank you, David. Talk to you again next week.
Very good. Have a good week yourself.
And coming up next, we'll talk to Fran Jensen, who is knee-deep in exploring the pension files of the veterans of the War of 1812. It's a project that numerous researchers are excited about on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, the Radio Root Sleuth. And on the line with me right now is Fran Jensen. And Fran was a speaker recently at a family history conference at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. And Fran, you had a fascinating story about your exploration of the War of 1812 files. And obviously, you have way too much time on your hands. Tell everybody what you've been up to.
Well, for the past year and a half, we have been perusing through the pension files as they've been digitized and placed on Fold 3, and actually viewing many of the files one by one. We were looking for some stories, some fantastic records, and information that were contained in the files, and we were just blown away by what we found in the files.
Who's we, Fran?
Myself and two other volunteers.
Okay.
So we've seen things like numerous original marriage certificates, family Bible pages that have been ripped out of family Bibles and sent in during the process of applying for pension or bounty land. And in one case, we actually saw that the entire Bible was sent in by the family, not just the Bible pages.
How do they store that? That's amazing.
I don't know how they store it back there in the National Archives, but I'm sure it's just sitting right there. All the pension files were originally stored in alphabetical order, so it's probably just sitting in alphabetical order.
That's funny. The Bible itself.
The pension. So that was just mind-boggling to see that.
Did they digitize every page in the Bible?
No. They only digitized the pages that were pertinent to history or family history.
Okay.
It was actually a Bible. I believe the date on the Bible, if I remember right, was 1815.
Right.
If I remember right.
Right from the end of the war.
Uh-huh, yeah. And obviously numerous family members were actually documented in the Bible on those pages, their births, their deaths, and their marriages. There was another pension file that we found for, the soldier's name was Frederick D. Bowles, B-O-L-L-E-S. We were amazed at the information that was in his file. There was a really, really long obituary for the wife. And with that obituary that was in the file, as well as the numerous other records that were in the file, we're able to find that individual on Family Search Family Tree, Frederick Boyles, and his wife, and they had one child in that record on Family Search. But in the pension file, we were able to identify the birthplace, the birth date, the death date, and place. The file confirmed that there was only one spouse for either the husband and the wife. In other words, the wife didn't remarry after
right.
the husband died. It gave the marriage date, marriage place. It identified that the couple had 12 children.
Oh, boy.
And at the time of the pension, four were still living. And the couple had 18 living grandchildren and six great-grandchildren. The file gave us all of that information, including the wife's father's name and one of her sister's names and where they were living. If it was my family, I would have been able to take that pension file and fill out all that information which was missing from the record on Family Search Family Tree. So what we're hoping is that people will find these records in the pension file and fill in all the missing blanks that they may have in their family records.
Now, what kind of military action stories have you stumbled across in these records?
Oh, military action stories. There have been stories where either the soldier himself or the wife, they will tell how they were injured or how they endured certain specific events in the war. In other words, they were exposed to extreme cold and it caused, you know, medical problems. And so we'll see medical records in the pension file that were used in an effort to obtain either the pension or the bounty land and prove that they were invalid and needed help through a pension, through some kind of support. And so being shot, losing a limb, the normal things you might see out of ravages of war, you'll see evidence of that also in the pension files.
I'm talking to Fran Jensen. She's been researching the War of 1812 pension files that are being released. How far along are we right now? I mean, there's percentages of them we see periodically going up 30%, 40%. What number have you seen lately, Fran?
I was on the Fultry website this morning, and it said 65%. They are currently digitizing the soldiers' names who begin with the letter M.
Oh, is it all done alphabetically?
Yeah, at the National Archives, the pensions are filed alphabetically, so they just started at the very beginning, and now they're working on the M's. I don't know how far they are into the M's, but they've been working on that for a few months now. So we will eventually get to the W's and the X's and the Y's. And we'll eventually get there. It's just been amazing, the stories and the information. Oh, just the other day, I was looking at one pension file. It had a little teeny tiny little clipping from a newspaper. Well, that newspaper clipping had nothing to do with the soldier, nothing to do with the person who was applying for the pension, which happened to be the daughter of the soldier. And the daughter was using that particular newspaper article to prove that she was the same type of a person, a living descendant of someone who served in the war, and so therefore she needed a pension, too, like this other person did. Well, so I went and looked for that other pension and found it. But that other pension mentioned somebody else who was the same situation, a daughter looking for support and hoping to obtain a pension like another daughter had obtained. And so it was actually one pension file that led to two other pension files. And interestingly enough, the very last pension file that the story actually linked to is actually missing and is not in the pension files on Fold 3. It's probably not even sitting there in the stack of files, pension files. And it looks, based upon the information we saw on Fold 3 in the pension, it's probably filed totally someplace else. And that's the file that I actually expect to see quite a bit of evidence and information about the family in that file, if it can ever be found, because the daughter was very young. I think she was 14 years old when her father passed away, and she was partially blind. And so that's why she was able to obtain a pension on behalf of her father's service, because of her age and because of her disability. Her pension file was actually an exception to the rules, and it was an act of Congress that actually made it possible for her to obtain her pension. We've seen several pension files where individuals have tried to obtain a pension under the current laws at the time and was not able to, but due to extenuating circumstances, bills went up to Congress, and then in many cases, when it was warranted, obviously, the pension was granted to the individual outside of the basic laws that were available at the
exceptions
time.
At the time. Fran, how many files are there? How many pensions were actually applied for?
We don't have an exact count. In the neighborhood of 100,000.
Okay.
The other interesting story, just to point out that even if your ancestor didn't serve in the war, you may find lots of information about your ancestors, multiple ancestors, in the file. So, for instance, I had an ancestor. He served in the war. His name was William Fuller Card. Card was the last name. And his son-in-law, his name is Benjamin Keeman Curtis. Well, Benjamin Keeman Curtis was born 14 years after the war. Well, guess what? Benjamin wrote a letter stating that he knew William Card and that he was there when he died and he was there when he was buried, and he wrote all that detail out about this person that he knew in the late 1840s who had passed away. And he actually wrote that he was living in his home at the time. And so both people, William Fuller Card and Benjamin Kingman Curtis, they're both my ancestors, but I would have never, ever thought to search for Benjamin Curtis in the War of 1812 files because he hadn't even been born yet.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, why would you look there?
In the Civil War.
Isn't that funny how that all works out? And then that can lead to other things. Now you can look
Absolutely.
In places and you can look for land records and start
Absolutely.
Tying those things together.
Yeah.
It is just amazing the little pieces that come together. The Revolutionary records are pretty much all available now. Now we've got War of 1812. Long ways we've come with the Civil War records, although I don't think there's ever an end to those.
I know.
You're not going to start going through those, are you?
Who knows?
Well, it's great things that are happening right now in our country with digitization and so many new stories coming out. And Fran, thank you so much for your time. This is very exciting stuff. And
yes,
I'm glad you've been doing this. And hopefully, is there a place you're sharing any of your finds?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The Digitization Project is actually sponsored by the Federation of Genealogical Societies and several other of the genealogical organizations, Ancestry.com, Pull3, Family Search. They are supporting this effort to digitize these records. They've never been microfilmed. They've never been so easily available to us. So just going online and being able to see something that normally in the past we would have had to have gone to Washington, D.C. in order to see it in person or hire somebody to obtain the file, a copy of the file for us. So to have them actually be online is fantastic. We have blog articles on the Federation of Genealogical Societies website for Preserve the Pensions, and we also have a Facebook page and a Facebook group. During the month of July, on the Facebook group, we shared one story from one pension every single day during the entire month of July.
Wow, fun stuff.
Yeah.
And that's up there still, probably.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
That's great. She's Fran Jensen. She's been researching the War of 1812 as these pension records have been released. Still another 35% to go before it's all out there and all available. Great stuff, Fran. Thanks for coming on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And coming up next, I'll be talking to Linda Emley. She's a Midwesterner who has dug up all kinds of information about a night that took place back in 1833 that's been dubbed the Night the Stars Fell. And our ancestors apparently went crazy that evening. All kinds of incredible stories. That's coming up on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. ExtremeGenes.com. Fisher here, the Radio Root Sleuth. You know, one of the ways to write a family history involves writing down your family's dates and names and then noting historical events that were happening at the same time. Well, many of these things are pretty well known and many others are not. Like the event my next guest has written about that I'd never heard about. From the Ray County Museum in Richmond, Missouri, it's Linda Emley. She is the museum manager. Hi, Linda. How are you?
I'm good.
I got to tell you, I was excited about the article I found that you wrote for the Richmond, Missouri Daily News about the night the stars fell. And you hear about these things once in a while. We think about Mark Twain and the comet in 1910 and the one that came the year he was born. But this one seemed to affect a lot of people. And you did a great story on it. First of all, what got you interested in it?
Well, we have a genealogy library here at the museum, and a lady came in, and we were working on her family history. And she said, I don't know when it was, but my great-great-grandmother was born the night the stars fell. And so a lady that was volunteering for me in the library, she goes, well, that was 1833. And we all kind of laughed.
Huh?
And goes, oh, yeah, that's one of those stories that is in all the old history books. So from there, we started piecing it all together and found out what a magnificent event this was because it affected so many people. Everybody thought the end of the world was here.
Right. Well, you know, you hear that a lot now. Remember the one that the comet that went through Russia a couple of years ago? That was pretty frightening.
Yeah, but this one happens every 33 years,
mm-hmm.
but in 1833, it was perfect because the weather was calm, the moon was low, and it was a perfect example that you could see so many more than you could the rest of the time. So it was one of those once-in-a-lifetime or probably once forever, the most perfect one that ever happened.
How much area was covered by this? I mean, I would assume that where you were, you've got some quotes in your story from people who lived in the Missouri area at the time. Obviously, they got a great look, but what about the rest of the country? What do you know about that?
Well, one of the stories in mine was a guy that was in Virginia. So it was all the way across the country. Elder Samuel Rogers, he was a circuit rider preacher, and he saw it there. So after research, all the newspapers everywhere were talking about it. So it was definitely seen around the world, but you know, in those days, you didn't hear so much about it. But you go back to old accounts, and everybody, every family has a legend about it.
Now, it started November 13th, 1833. It went a few days. They called it part of the Leonid meteor shower. And so this comes every 33 years, which means the next time we see it'll be around 2031 or something like that, right? Always in November.
I don't have the actual chart on it, but there was a place that gave you how often it came through. So it's actually 32.5.
32. Oh, that changes everything now. So we're probably looking at 2029 or something like that. So tell us some of the stories of some of the people. You mentioned the circuit preacher in Virginia. Who else did you run across?
Well, locally here in Ray County, we had two families that were coming up the Missouri River from Kentucky, and Lexington, Missouri is on the other side of the river from us, and they had to camp on the river that night. So we had the Jabez Shotwell family and his 7 children, and then Edward Wall and his 11 children. So they were all camping, waiting to cross the river in the morning to come over to Ray County, and their family traditions had passed it down. Bruna McGuire, she was a little old lady that was a local historian. She said as they could not cross the Missouri River on the boat that day, they camped on the Slusher Farm the night the stars fell. One of the family, seeing the sparks, called out to the squire, "Stop stirring up the fire. You might set the tents on fire."
Oh, wow.
So he said, "Come here and look. The world's going to come to an end." So, and they were talking about some of the slaves that were there, that they all fell on the ground, and they all thought that the world was going to end. And it wasn't until the sun came up the next morning that they all realized that life was going on. So it rained stars all night long.
Now, was anything actually hitting the earth?
Well, they said some of them were, like, bigger than normal, and then they would break up, and then 2 or 3 of them would come down, and they'd go behind trees. But they all felt like they were hitting the earth. And I've always, I collect rocks, and I've always looked for meteorites that might have come from that event, and
right.
I haven't found any for sale. But you know there had to be when that many were fallen. There had to be meteorites that hit the ground.
So. You would think so, but yeah, how would you know when they got here?
Yeah.
So who else commented on this thing?
Well, there was a little slave girl. She was living in Tennessee. And there's a great genealogy story out there about her descendant, Angela Walton. And she found a quilt that Harriet Powers put together that had about the nights the stars fell, had a panel on an old slave quilt. And so she had always heard the story about her Amanda, and then she finally figured out how old Amanda was because they gave a general idea that she was just a little girl. So they figured out that she was born around 1820s. So it's a wonderful story there because Amanda said that all the slave owners thought the world was ending, so they came out and started telling all their people where they came from, who their families were, and where their mothers and fathers were. So they were all making...
Repenting.
They were getting ready for Judgment Day, is what it said. So.
Uh-huh. And so they just figured it's not much point in freeing them, but here's who your parents are and where they went. Unbelievable.
Yeah, and so the next morning, all of them were happy because they finally found out more about their family history. So that's what it's all about. Can you imagine somebody knowing your family story and then they start telling it to you? And it would just be like a miracle that somebody came along and offered all your information. So I thought that was really,
yes.
I'd love to have somebody come up and tell me all of my history. So
very special.
And then we've got Parley Pratt. Parley Pratt actually spent time in Richmond. When we were having the Mormon Wars in Missouri, he was one of them that came to Richmond and was here with Joseph Smith. So when I found a story about him, it touched close to me because of all the Mormon history we have here in Ray County.
Mm-hmm.
They were up in Jackson County, and they were all being driven out of Jackson County, and they were being pursued. And when all this happened, it stopped the pursuit. And it was like a miracle. So everybody felt like, you know, that this was a sign from God that they were going to go on and life was going to be good here. So
that actually saved some lives that night.
Yes, and affected the whole future. My biggest thing was to find out why this one in 1833 was the biggest one that was ever out there. So I went all the way back through history and researched one whole night. And then I found we're in 902 A.D., Plato was talking about a similar meteorite shower. So it had to be the same one.
Right.
This kept coming back over and over and over. It was interesting because when it comes around every 33 years, it's always out there. It's just amazing that the way the Earth revolves around everything, and you think of it shooting through the sky and just keep going straight forever, but it actually is revolving around. So the whole idea of how meteorites work were pretty amazing to me. And then I love the difference of a meteoroid is shooting through the air. When it starts to burn up, it becomes a meteor when it's shooting through the sky. Then when it hits the Earth, it's a meteorite. So I'm like, you think of one rock, and the name changes and what it's doing at the time. So, you know, being analytical as I am, I thought that was really different, the meteoroid, a meteor, and a meteorite.
Absolutely. And, you know, to think that this goes on every 33 years, I'm trying to remember. I mean, I remember Hale-Bopp, the comet that went through back, I want to say, in the 90s. And it was the most incredible thing I'd ever seen in my lifetime. But I don't remember a Leonid meteor shower quite like what's being described here.
Yeah, so, you know, there's so many different versions of it, but this is one of them that's the most spectacular. And then, you've got things like Halley's Comet that everybody knows about, but this is one of those that you don't think about it until you start reading up on it, and it's so, you know, so very interesting. But think 902 A.D. with Plato. That's beginning of time.
Wow.
You know, it all comes from the beginning of written history.
She's Linda Emily. She's the museum manager at Ray County Museum in Richmond, Missouri. She's written an article about the night the sky fell. You can find it linked on our website, extremejeans.com. Linda, thanks so much for coming on.
Well, you're welcome. It's always fun to share a little piece of history.
Absolutely. And coming up next, it's Tom Perry, our Preservation Authority, answering your questions on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. It is Fisher here at the Radio Root Sleuth with Tom Perry. Tom, welcome back. Good to have you.
Good to be back.
Well, we're hearing a lot of people who are having trouble playing discs. They record it on one machine. They send it to somebody who has the same machine, and the disc won't play. What's going on there?
Okay, you run into this a lot. It's an incompatibility problem. It's almost common sense, but sometimes we put on blinders when we're buying stuff. You know, like I tell people when they come into our store, we had a couple last week that came in and says, hey, I bought one of these VHS to DVD machines, or I bought one of these little boxes that I plug my VHS into or my Hi-8 and then plug it into my computer, and I go and burn these discs, and there's glitches in it, or it looks fine, but then I send it off to my uncle. He pops in his DVD player, and it won't play. Okay, the reason for this is the quality of the parts. You know, the same reason Maserati costs more than a Ford Fiesta, you know? It's the parts that are in it that make the hole, so to speak.
Right.
And so what happens is, we've said this before, most computers are not made to turn stuff from analog to digital. That's not what they're designed for.
Right.
They're designed to work with digital information they're giving and compact it, move around, do whatever. So what happens, you have these little boxes that are usually like $50, and the reason it's $50 is the components in them are pretty cheap. And so what happens, you plug your VHS into it, this little box is trying to turn all your analog stuff into digital, and then put it in a format that the computer understands. It's like we have too much earwax in one ear, and it's not hearing the conversation right.
Right.
So it's getting your zeros and your ones all mixed up, and there's nothing worse in this world than getting your zeros and ones mixed up.
Can't have that.
Oh, absolutely not. So you're getting glitches and all kinds of stuff. And then once in a while, in some of your machines, which we mentioned, that is actually a VHS, a DVD machine, that it doesn't have the box in between. And you go and do stuff and you say, oh, yeah, this looks beautiful. This is wonderful. And then you send that out to Aunt Margaret. She pops it in and says, you sent me a blank disc. There's nothing on the disc. It says it can't read it. It says I need to put a different disc in. And she sends it back to you. You pop it in. It plays fine. The reason why these machines at Costco or Sam's Club are a couple $100 is the same reason a Fiesta is as inexpensive as it is. The components are really cheap. Those machines are made for you to record television or whatever you want to do, or transfer your VHS tapes to DVD for you to use on that machine.
Mm.
So it's basically almost proprietary information that's on that machine, and it's so loosely written that this machine says, oh, okay, this is stupid, but I know what it means because it's my machine.
Well, now, is there a way to copy that file, say, onto your desktop, and then it's playable on something else?
Usually not. Sometimes if you have a higher-end computer and you have the right software, sometimes you can take this DVD that you've made, which if you ever take a DVD, a quality DVD, and put it in your computer, it'll say it's a TS file. If you look at it where it shows you the thumbnails, you go, there's a video TS and an audio TS. Why is that? Really quickly, in the old copyright days, they made this so it's harder to copy DVDs. So you have a TS file for video and TS file for audio. And what happens is these kind of get corrupt and they don't play together. And if you separate them and try to put them back together, they'll never work. But sometimes if you have a good program, you can take the TS file and convert it to an MOV and then take that MOV and make it into a QuickTime movie, put it on your Facebook page, then email that to Aunt Margaret if she's computer literate, and then she should be able to play it okay.
Wow. I mean, that sounds very complex.
Oh, it is.
Challenging, isn't it?
Oh, it is. It's very much just like if somebody speaks Spanish, they might be able to understand some people in Portuguese and different languages that are close. But it's not going to be really, really good enough to, you know, get by. And that's a problem you're going to run in with these machines, the reason they're so cheap. And I tell people, if I could go and buy equipment for $250, I wouldn't be spending $3,500 on the machine. Because we have to guarantee our job. When somebody brings us in a VHS, it better work when they get their DVD home. And we'll go into a little bit more of incompatibility of problems concerning disc, why they might not work for you as well in the second segment.
All right. Final segment of Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show and ExtremeGenes.com. I am Fisher, the Radio Root Sleuth, with Tom Perry, the Preservation Authority, answering a question about dealing with discs and compatibility. And it sounds like it's quite complicated, Tom. And most of it has to do with the fact that most of the equipment that's available to us through Costco and other outlets is just not very good quality material.
Exactly. You know, you have to understand that when you're buying something, 9 out of 10 times you get what you pay for. And the thing is, things have changed so much, even with camcorders. I remember my first camera situation when I used to shoot NFL films, it was like a $30,000 system. You can go and buy for $2,000 or $3,000 a Canon video camera now that blows that thing away, and it's a few thousand dollars. So this real good quality equipment is getting into people's hands. They have no idea what they're doing with it. People are starting to be DIY people, do-it-yourself people. They need to be educated on this kind of stuff. So just because you buy a machine, don't just plug it in and start doing stuff. Read the manual. As much as everybody hates to read the manual, do research online, find out what you need to do. And a lot of times, somebody will go and spend $200 or $300 to buy a machine thinking they're going to be able to do all this stuff, and they find out they can't. Now they wasted $200 or $300. They end up sending their tapes into us anyway to have them transferred. So save yourself some of those problems. Take it to us. Take it to another good quality place and make sure that they get it right. Now, going back to the incompatibility problem, that can happen even with your discs. People call me all the time and say, hey, and say, I'm looking at these discs. There's plus R's. There's minus R's. There's DL. There's RW's. What do I buy? What should I go with?
Yeah, what does this mean?
Exactly. The thing is, plus R's were the first discs to come out, so it's kind of like experimental. And when they first came out, Sony and Apple were kind of not interested in carrying them. They wanted to wait till the Dash R disc came out, which is a better disc, but they're still selling plus R's even though they don't need to anymore. But about 3 or 4 years ago, Sony and Apple started making their Macs and their Sony machines compatible with the plus R's just because there were so many out there. But if you have the choice to pick between a plus R and a Dash R disc, I would always go with a Dash R. I have so much better luck with Dash R discs than I do plus R's. And they're usually the same price anyway. It's just the format they've used. So basically, back to the cheap equipment, it's cheaper to make a driver that reads or burns a plus R disc than is a dash R disc. I can always buy plus R stuff cheaper than I can dash R. And it's just like the old VHS Betamax thing. Oh, this is cheaper. This is what I'm going to go with. Where cheaper sometimes isn't the best way to go. So try to find a machine that burns dash R's because it's going to last longer and it's the better way to go. And I really don't like dual layer disc because major incompatibility problems with them. Because usually people say, oh, I've got this thing, it's 4 hours long, I don't want to go to Blu-ray, but I don't want to use two discs. Go ahead and do two discs because it's going to be cheaper for you to duplicate two standard discs than one dual layer disc. Plus, a lot of machines have problems playing dual layer discs. If it's not professionally done, I stay away from dual-layer discs. I talk clients out of using them all the time. If you're having a disc replicated, like a Disney DVD you'd buy in the store, so you're buying like 1,000 of them, they're stamping them out, then dual-layer discs are fine because they're all zeros and ones, they're in the right place. Everything's going to go well if you're using a dual-layer disc that is basically a professional disc that's stamped out, not one that you burn at home. Now, about the RW discs, I don't like rewritable discs because same thing like we talked about a few weeks ago about reusing the tape. They can get worse. Same thing with discs. As it erases the zeros, rewrites zeros, the die actually gets weaker. And so the more times you write on it, the less compatible it's going to be. And discs are so inexpensive. Don't get RW discs. They're just going to cause you all kinds of problems.
All right. Great stuff, Tom. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to have been here.
Thanks once again to Fran Jensen for coming on and talking to us about the War of 1812 Pension Project. Linda Emley from Richmond, Missouri, talking about The Night the Stars Fell. Talk to you next week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org. This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.